to another edition of Stephen A's World, the podcast. On this episode, we have four women who are doing big things. Up first is ABC's Lindsay Davis. We get into everything from her writing children's books to the social injustices going on and everything in between. Welcome to Stephen A's World. How are you?
I am well. In my mind, I was going to come out like to the Get Your Numbers song. You know, like you came out in the celebrity basketball game. But it's good to talk to you, my friend.
When you talk about Soul of a Nation, I mean, obviously, again, highlighting the black experience, some of the issues that have been pertinent to the black community. Did you feel this series was necessary? And if so, why? I imagine the answer is yes, because I'm here to tell you I think it's yes. Oh. But why did you feel it was necessary?
And overdue, as a matter of fact. I mean, you know, but I feel like the soil is kind of fertile in this particular moment because you have ears that are willing to hear. You know, I think that there has been this desire and need to have this conversation within the black community and beyond it. But I don't know that people were willing to really lean in and engage and listen. And unfortunately, it seemed like it took, you know, George Floyd and the aftermath of that, the summer of protests and the so-called racial reckoning that we're in, for people to really think, OK, yeah, maybe we need to unpack this thing. Maybe there are some conversations that need to be had. And I even say so-called racial reckoning because, you know, people act like that happened, you know, over the summer, as if something has been taken to account. And we have now kind of moved on beyond that. And we've had multiple black men who have been killed by police subsequently. And you don't really hear so much about that anymore. Casey Goodson, Andre Hill, just weeks apart, just within Columbus, Ohio, you know, a few months ago. And again, you know, one had Subway sandwich, the other had a cell phone in his hand. And where are those conversations? And that's why I feel like this really needs to be at the forefront, to kind of pull back the curtain, if you will, on black society and black culture and black people.
Let's move on from this in this regard. I want to move forward by asking this question. Oftentimes, since in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing, I've said to many people, I've encountered numerous white folks who have said, excuse me, can't we move past this? Enough's enough already. We heard you. We hear you loud and clear. We're listening. Can we move past this? I want to know, A, have you encountered that yourself? And B, do you believe, or based on your reporting, do you get the impression that that was just lip service, that folks who swore that they were listening really were not, and that our society is not as woke as it pretends to be?
You know, yeah, I feel like people got the T-shirt. They felt like, you know, they marched their one protest and now let's move on. And I kind of think that that's the interesting overarching theme and parallel, if you will, of tonight's show with the idea of, as Nick talks about, atonement versus apology. Right. You know, there have been apologies made to black Americans as far as slavery. But now you hear these really interesting conversations about reparations, about some kind of atonement, some kind of action behind those words. And, you know, I think that a lot of times people have good intentions. People don't know what they don't know. They're not necessarily aware of racism and how pervasive it is. And I think there are a lot of people who feel like, look, I'm not responsible for the sins of my great great grandfather. But until you have that healing, until you have that compensation or conversation or whatever it is, you know, I don't know how easy it is to make amends, especially when you have the legacies of slavery so prominent throughout our society today.
How far do you think Soul of a Nation is going to go first in really illuminating that reality and B, ultimately reaching or helping to reach a solution in that regard towards that thinking?
I think what we can do, Stephen, is put it on the table, right? We can present it, and then it's up to people to process it. It's up to people to listen to it. It's up to people to really reflect and think about it. You know, you mentioned before, you know, how I write children's books, and I always talk about how it's so important just for children to be able to get a window, right? That there's an essay that was written a long time ago about how mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors, and how children's books need mirrors so the kids can see themselves reflected in the pages, but they also need windows so they can perhaps peer into a world that's unfamiliar to their own. And I feel like that's where we are right now with society. We need windows. We need people to stop worrying about their own reflection and their own images as much as they need to get familiar with somebody, step outside of perhaps their comfort zone, peer into a world that's unfamiliar to their own.
On a personal level, how much pressure is applied to you when you take into account the fact that as the first black woman to anchor a major news network since Carol Simpson almost two decades ago? I mean, there's a lot of people might look at you and feel like there's a level of added pressure that you must be feeling to illuminate those things and to bring that to the forefront. Your level of credibility obviously coming into consideration and having the credibility that you have is what I'm trying to say. Do you feel any added pressure because you're a black woman in this position?
Sure, I 100% do. There is a responsibility that I feel. There is a weight to it that I feel. You know, I grew up in a household. My dad would always talk about how as a black woman, as a black person in general, you're going to have to run faster. You're going to have to jump higher. You're going to have to shoot straighter just to make the team.
Yeah.
And I also am mindful of Carol Simpson, you know, who had the position first 18 years ago, was the first black woman to anchor any major network newscast. And when I interviewed her prior to assuming this position in February, she talked about how she was the first woman of color to moderate a presidential debate. And she said how she felt, how women were saying, "Hey, Carol, do it for us." And black people were like, "Hey, Carol, do it for us." And she also had her own interest at heart, right, in excelling and black excellence. And so you do feel like you kind of carry the weight for everybody. It's a gift, though, and it's a blessing, and I'm glad to have it. But you do kind of get the sense when you're black, when you're a woman, that sometimes, like, if you don't knock it out of the park, then maybe you ruined it for the next person. Maybe they're not going to hire a black person, you know, right after you. And I do feel that that's a lot of weight, but I take it and carry that responsibility.
And carrying it great thus far. Let me go to the other interest. Stay your children's book, your third, Stay This Way Forever. What inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, so I have a little boy who's about to be 7 years old in just a few days. And basically, when I was reading books to him, I started thinking initially, oh, I could do this, you know, and that soon turned to, I need to do this. So a lot of people look at, you know, news industry totally different from writing children's books. But at the heart of it, I consider myself to be a storyteller. And the more I was reading books, the more I was thinking I could do this. But then I started seeing how intentional and deliberate I had to be to find books with pages that look like my son. And so I felt, okay, I've got to do this. I have a responsibility to do this. Rather than complain, let me be a part of the solution and create children's books with black and brown characters. And again, just because a lot of people get it wrong and think because the characters are black and brown, they're only for black and brown children. Couldn't be further from the truth. Again, that's that idea. As you have the adults who are reading How to Be an Anti-Racist, what books are you putting into your children's hands? How diverse are your bookshelves and your book collections for your children? I think that if you live in an area that's not very diverse, your school, your place of worship is not very diverse, your own family is not, then you can introduce this to children through books and toys, kids who don't look like them. Because quite often it's what we're not familiar with that causes the fear.
And you talked about black and brown. It ain't just for black and brown folks. As I like to say it this way, Lindsay, it ain't just about black appeal. It's about mass appeal. That's what it's about. It's about mass. It's about mass appeal. But listen, before I let you get on out of here, Alan Houston. Is that your brother-in-law? Is that your brother-in-law?
Yes. Yeah. He married my cousin, and then she introduced me to my husband, and so very incestuous. And hey, before you let me go, I want to say congratulations to you about the Black Excellence and the project you're working on, the HBCUs docuseries. Hats off to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. By the way, before I let you get on out of here, does that mean, are you following the Knicks? Are you seeing the progress that the New York Knicks are making? Allen Houston's not there any longer, but they're becoming respectable again. Have you been noticing?
He's still in the front office, long-suffering Knicks
That's
fan.
Right.
I still remember that 1999 shot he had, 7 seconds left on the clock, Miami
That's right. Heat. We'll take it, Lindsay. We'll take it after what That's we've been dealing with recently. We will take it, okay? Keep doing the marvelous
Amen.
Work that you're doing, okay?
Thank you very much.
Big thanks to Lindsay Davis. What she's been working on is important, so go check her out. Now, to another powerful and brilliant woman. We have Michelle Roberts, the executive director of the National Basketball Players Association. We get into the players speaking up this past season, vaccines, and much, much more. As you reflect on your career thus far, just looking at everything that you've been able to do with the National Basketball Players Association, what comes to your mind? How do you feel about leading this organization over the last 6-7 years?
Now, let's be careful about the term leading, because
okay.
as you know, Stephen A., these men are not exactly to be led.
Right.
But to the extent I can help empower them, and that's what I've tried to do. That's what I think my staff and I have done pretty good job of doing. These are phenomenal human beings who deserve to be treated as the phenomenal human beings that they are. And so, you know, my marching orders were to make sure that the world respected them for what they both bring to the game and for who they are in our community. So I feel proudly that we've accomplished that.
What was your biggest challenge in taking this job in 2014?
It frankly was establishing credibility. You may recall that the circumstances that led to my hire began when my predecessor was terminated. And when I took the job, there was some bad blood relative to the concept of a union, the utility of the union, the value of a union. I think many of the players thought that the union was a necessary headache. And so my challenge was to convince the players that the union is not a headache. It is not a liability. It is a tremendous asset. And that the people who were going to be working for them were going to be doing it with their best interests in mind. So it was really a question of establishing credibility. It didn't happen immediately. It took a lot of work. And with the blessings of a very dedicated and talented staff, I think we got there.
You know, I look at the Players Association, and obviously Chris Paul has been the president of the Players Association. I think he's done a fabulous job. You've got vice presidents, including people like Andre Iguodala, who's to be incredibly respected. I could see him being in the president's seat someday in the future, and there's no question. But as you talked about, these guys are not to be led per se, because they consider themselves leaders as well. They should be. But you are no pushover. You're not anybody that knows you. You don't push Michelle Robbins around. That does not happen. So in gaining that level of respect, how do you believe that you were able to do it? Because when you speak to the players, they speak very, very glowingly about you.
Well, I mean, when you respect someone, it's hard, and you express that, it's sort of difficult for them not to give it back. One of the things that I think may have been the most concerning about my tenure before I started was whether or not, frankly, I was going to be tough enough. I mean, the league can be a bit of a bear, and players had been of the view, rightly or wrongly, that they were not being given the modicum of respect that they deserved. And historically, that may have been true, but this is an evolving group this generation is an evolving group of men, and frankly, they wanted to make sure I was up to the task. So the good news is I came from my life before I got here was one where I pretty much had to fight. And what they wanted to make sure they saw for me fairly soon was an ability to fight and, frankly, a willingness to fight. Anybody can be a pushover. And so once they determined that, the promise that I made to them and the history of my professional development actually would allow me to be the kind of warrior that they needed. It's been smooth. I was going to say it's been smooth sailing from there, but that's not true. It's been pretty cool.
I got you. You know, I think about what you've had to endure over the last year. You've got COVID-19, and obviously had a season was postponed and halted last March 11th. And then we had the obvious killing of George Floyd by a police officer, which really sparked the social justice movement, not just nationwide, but as far as I'm concerned, to a degree, globally. When you consider the global iconic brand that the NBA is, can you speak to what kind of challenges you and the NBPA personally faced in light of COVID-19 and the social justice issues and what this past year has been like for you in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, COVID, it was an amazing marriage of unpredictables, right? I mean, obviously, police brutality has been a problem in our community for many, many years. Sadly, it's been more than a recent problem. And so having to tackle that would have been, in and of itself, a huge burden. But to do that on top of having to deal with this pandemic was, on many days, I thought, just too much for us to bear. The art players are such influencers and have such a following that what they do has, as you mentioned, an impact not simply in our country, but globally. And so as I watch the players both respond to not being able to play and then being advised to engage in certain restrictive conduct. I mean, these are men that are not accustomed to being told what to do on the regular, right? So saying things like, we want to test you every day, we want you to stay home, we want you to wear masks, and then we'll let you know if you're going to play again. That was tough enough. And then George Floyd happened and Breonna. And the players did what I love about them, and that is they said, you know, I'm not going to sit in my very expensive perch. I'm going to hit the streets because I'm affected by this. And so, you know, all of us were out there trying to make clear our outrage at what was going on in the community. And then there was the issue of, well, okay, let's play again. Should we? Right? I mean, are we going to now be taking attention away now that we've joined arms and focused attention on this issue? Should we resume play? And as you know, proudly, they did both resume play and continue to keep the conversation going.
Let me transition to the issue of vaccines and vaccination, because obviously that's something that's going to come to the forefront in the weeks to come. Certainly the players can't be forced to do anything, but nevertheless, the league is unapologetic about the fact that it's something that they're going to encourage, and they're hopeful that not only will players take vaccinations because they believe that's the only way, like most folks in the medical industry included, they believe that's the only way to get out of this pandemic. They're going to encourage people not just to take it, but they also want these players to encourage others who are not playing to get vaccinated as well. What are your thoughts about that?
At the end of the day, I think it's a personal decision. It will be for me, and I think it will be for the players. And so, yeah, the league is encouraging it. We have our own epidemiologists that are spending a lot of time speaking with the players. We're having meetings with our players to discuss their concerns. I believe a good number of them will take it. But as to whether or not they'll become spokespeople for it, again, it's a personal decision.
Having said all of that, the NBA, I thought, was incredibly successful this past summer when you had a bubble postseason. Do you anticipate another postseason like that, where there's a bubble that's instituted, or do you think things are going to stay status quo, where teams are going to be traveling to play one another? I'm talking about for the postseason specifically.
Yeah, Stephen A., as you can imagine, it's almost not even one day at a time, but 1 hour at a time, right? So I'm spending a lot of time in the last few days trying to understand what all these new variants mean. Right. The vaccine, thank God for the vaccine, everyone says, but we're now worried that maybe these variants are going to pose a challenge to the vaccine. So the bubble was never off the table, even for this last season, though the players threatened me if there was going to be a bubble for the entire season. But we all understood, that, especially since it was successful, that the bubble might have to reemerge. So we all hope that we can stay home, right, and not have to be separated from our families. But I would not sit here and tell you that under no circumstances might we not find ourselves postseason back in the bubble. Because at the end of the day, it's got to be a safe environment.
My last question to you is this. You basically announced that you were going to retire before COVID, but then COVID came about and you stayed on the job. I haven't heard anybody that said they want Michelle Roberts to leave. So based on that, are you sticking around? Are you going to be around for a long time to come to continue to work with these players and represent these players? I mean, what's the plan, Michelle Roberts?
Long time, no. Michelle promised herself some time ago that she was going to enjoy retirement as long as she kept her health. I'm not going to leave until I think the players are in a place where, you know, we've got some level of normalcy. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't mean to say that not until the pandemic is over, because I don't know when the pandemic is going to be over.
Yeah.
But you know, at the end of the day, since I don't have long-term plans to stay at the PA, I'm working with the executive committee and the other players to find someone that can step in so we can have a smooth transition, just as you would have succession at any organization. So when, I don't know. Long time, no way. No way.
I got you.
I need a break.
I sincerely mean it when I say it's always an honor and a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen A., and thank you for your support of the players. You have been a great friend to the union.
Shout out to Michelle Roberts and the things the NBPA has been doing on and off the court. Our final guests are Jocelyn Lamoureux Davidson and Monique Lamoureux Mirando. twin sisters who shined in the game of hockey who recently retired. But that just means more time for them to do bigger things off the ice. I can't wait for you to talk about this Dare to Make History. Monique, I'll start with you. Who did you write this book for? Can you tell us that? Who was your target audience when you wanted to talk about this?
We honestly believe that our story is going to resonate with so many people. And I think specifically our fight for gender equity within USA Hockey, I think resonates not just with women, but I think it just with everyone. It doesn't always have to be gender equity is not just a female problem. That's everyone's problem. And everybody needs to be around the table to generate conversations and make change. And so we truly believe that the stories that we've woven throughout the book are really for everybody.
You know, Jocelyn, when everybody talks about this, I mean, there's always a touch point. There's always a key moment that really sparks you. It's inside of you. It's issues that you all want to address without question. But there's always a moment that says, you know what, enough's enough. We really need to move full steam ahead and make this point and really address these issues head on. When was that moment for you all?
Well, I think in 2015, between the two of us and our leadership group, we really just said enough is enough. We're either going to make change and we're going to be a vehicle for that change, or we can't just sit here and commiserate. And so I think the biggest moment was kind of sitting around the table with our teammates saying, we got to be the group to do this. If we don't do it, who else is going to be the next generation? We need to create change and we're the group to do it. And so I think it was a collective, cohesive agreement that our team was the one that was going to do it.
This question is for either one of you. When you say change, you needed to create change. What exactly needed to be changed? I mean, I'm talking in terms of details. What was it that was happening with you young ladies and the sport itself that made you say enough's enough? This has to be changed. Specifically, what were you being deprived of? Can you tell the audience that?
So I think very relatable issues were just how the men's team traveled is how the women's team should travel. We shouldn't have the players sitting in the back of a plane on an 8-hour flight. If the men get $50 a day per diem, the women should get 50, not 15. If the men and the boys get world championship rings, the women and the girls should get world championship rings. And so there are little things like that were happening throughout our career, but then also just not being supported. Our obligation to USA Hockey, we had to be at a camp or a tournament every 6 to 8 weeks, but also had to work a full-time job on top of that to support ourselves because we were not financially being supported. And so we believe that if you want to have the best team in the world, you should support them in that way. And at the time, we did not feel we had that support. And so we were able to create significant change in 2017. And that is just the foundation and the start of where we hope women's hockey is going.
What did that contract accomplish, Monique? And I'm asking you that question because obviously, again, when a lot of folks need to know specifics. Like, for example, when you were talking about the hotels, I'm like sitting here, I'm saying, I want to know details. Are they putting y'all in a Motel 6? I'd want to know that, for crying out loud, because you never know with some of these organizations, particularly as it pertains to gender equity. It's a lot of lovely young ladies that contribute a lot to the sports world that are deprived of a lot of things. But I'm thinking along the lines of, in terms of what your contract accomplished, did the league go through with you in terms of agreed upon terms? What exactly was agreed upon contractually that you really want to highlight and you really highlighted in this book? Can you tell us that?
Yeah, so we were able to negotiate getting a livable wage. So we weren't asking for six-figure salaries or anything like that. We were just asking for a livable wage so we could live and train as athletes and not be working full-time jobs on the side when being an elite athlete is a full-time job. We negotiated maternity benefits that Joss and I were actually the first players to benefit from that allowed us to continue to play and come back in a safe manner. And we didn't have to choose between having a family and continuing our hockey careers, even though we just recently retired a few weeks ago. I'm trying to think. We created a women's advisory committee, which is supposed to support the growth and more opportunities for women and girls in the sport. And whatever opportunities the boys teams were having, we should also create those opportunities for girls teams. So there's a development program that supports a U17 and a U18 boys we should have that same reciprocal program for the girls. And so there are things that we're still pushing for, that we're still fighting for. But at a national team level, we did gain much more financial support. But there's, like we said, much, much more room to grow. This is just the foundation and the start.
You accomplished a great deal, no question about it, and both of you are to be commended for it. I truly congratulate you on all of this. But the contract does expire in April. Now, after 14 years, I think if I remember correctly, y'all announced your retirement in February, but after 14 years of doing this, how involved are you going to be with future contract negotiations? Because some of these organizations, now that you're gone, they can have the mentality, excuse me, we don't have to really worry about them, and we don't have to be consistent with what we're trying to do moving forward. I imagine you're not going to let them try and get away with that. That you still intend to be, vehemently involved. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We're currently two of eight players that are on the negotiating committee that are currently in conversations with USA Hockey, renegotiating the new contract since the one is expiring at the end of March, I believe. And so, like Jocelyn has said multiple times, that this first contract that we signed is the building block and the foundation, and we certainly do not want to go backwards in any way, shape, or form. Off the first contract, we want to continue to build off that and continue to grow hockey and women's hockey specifically in the U.S. so we can continue to grow the sport and make it
accessible for everybody.
And I think it's our last opportunity as players to have, you know, a stamp on the program. We're proud of the work we've done in the last 14 years, but this is by far the most important part of our career, and this is our last opportunity to have an impact on the program.
What's the next step? I'll ask you this last question, and either one of you can take it. Honored to have you again on the show. I'd like to know what you think is the next step for women's equity in the world of sports, not just hockey, but in the entire world of sports. What do you think is the next step that needs to be taken as you move forward?
I think the next step is more investment in women's sports. I don't think the argument of the men bringing in more money is always a fair argument, because there's been way more investment and way more dollars put into
and time
put into men's sports. And you need to give that dollar and time to women's sports. And when you do that, I think it grows, and it grows at an exponential rate. And so for women's hockey specifically, we need a professional league where the best players are playing year in and year out, and that so fans can see women's hockey every single year, not just 2 weeks during the Olympics. I think that's the biggest challenge that women's hockey is facing right now. But I believe that the attention and the motivation is there to create one league by the right people. And we're not playing anymore, but if we can be a part of that solution and creating that opportunity, we want to be involved. But yeah, I think we need to support women's sports. We need to talk about women's sports. We need to cover women's sports, and they just need to be in the conversation.
Dare to make history. Jocelyn Lamoureux, Davidson, Monique Lamoureux, Miranda, thank you so much for being on the show. Really honored to have you. Congratulations for all that you've done and all that you will continue to do. Really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you to all four of these women for joining me. All of them are doing important stuff and just getting started. And thanks again to everyone for listening. Make sure to rate, review, and follow. And be sure to check out my TV show on ESPN Plus, Stephen A's World. If you don't have ESPN Plus, head over to ESPNplus.com to sign up now.